Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us here this morning. We're here in the, we're nestled in this beautiful room called the Window Room of the Gallery Building, Regina Old Campus. We also have, by video conference, by link up, we have folks at the U of S campus, Johnson Tsuyama Graduate School, and of course at 2 Research Drive at the main campus of the University of Regina. This morning we have an interesting opportunity to renew our understanding about this historic agreement in Saskatchewan, an agreement that seeks to resolve unfinished treaty business between governments and First Nations. Through mutual understanding, negotiations, and leaps of faith, both First Nation and governments have been able to agree on a process resolves treaty land entitlement, or seeks to resolve treaty land entitlement here in Saskatchewan. In 1992, an agreement was signed between First Nations and governments. Last September marked the 20th anniversary of the Treaty Land Entitlement Framework Agreement. And while the work continues to implement and fulfill the terms of the Framework Agreement, other First Nations have found opportunity and have used the 92 Framework Agreement as a foundation to resolve their own claims. Our efforts this morning is part of an initiative of the Johnson Tsuyama Graduate School to inform and educate public servants, practitioners, and members of the general public about policy issues affecting First Nation and Métis people in Saskatchewan. In addition to our partnership with the Indigenous People's Health Research Center, Johnson Tsuyama seeks to provide these information sessions to provide learning opportunities about policy that impacts First Nation and Métis populations in Saskatchewan. So in a time when we have a number of movements and a lot of public awareness and a lot of public attention to the I Don't Know More movement, it's a good time to inform people and practitioners about the various issues and policies affecting First Nation and Métis people. I'm glad that everybody has been able to join us here this morning. Our objectives for the panel this morning, and I ask you to keep these in mind, to renew the working knowledge of the 1992 Treaty Land Entitlement Framework Agreement among First Nation and government officials, to ensure the understanding of responsibilities of each of the parties pursuant to the Framework Agreement, and to outline future challenges and opportunities by continuing with the implementation of the Framework Agreement. And of course, to continue the dialogue among officials to ensure that the objectives of the Framework Agreement are met. Keep those panel objectives in mind throughout the day. We hope to accomplish at least some of them. I'm sure we will with our panelists this morning. By the way, my name is Ron Crow. I'm now with the Johnson Tsuyama Graduate School, and throughout my career I've been working on policy issues and in public administration in some capacity or another. I'm from the Paiute First Nation, member of the part of Treaty 4 and a Treaty 4 citizen, and I'm glad that we have this opportunity to be here this morning. I also want to thank our moderator in Saskatoon, Daniel Balan, who will be acting as our moderator, and thank Daniel for her efforts this morning in helping us out. There we go. Today's panelists are to provide us with some of their knowledge and experience on the topic of treaty land entitlement, and they include Dwayne Johns, is with the Government of Canada and is currently Director of Lands and Economic Development with Aboriginal and Northern Affairs Canada. In the Saskatchewan region. He's a member of the Pascal First Nation, also a Treaty 4 First Nation. He's an avid community-minded individual, a 20-year career in the federal government, and a fairly good golfer. He's kicked my butt on the course a few times. So, we haven't golfed a lot in the last little while, but he's always been a fairly good golfer. Patricia Delorme Hill, born and raised in the Mohawk community of Kahnawake, the South Shore of Montreal, and a member of the Kahnawake First Nation. She received her law degree from Queen's University and completed her articles with the Attorney General of Canada back in 1994. And she's practiced law as a solicitor in Quebec, where she worked for Legal Services Department of the Mohawk Council of Kahnawake. Trisha moved to Regina in 1998 and has worked both with the feds and federal government and the province in intergovernmental and Aboriginal affairs. Since 2004, Trisha has worked with the government of Saskatchewan. She's currently the Executive Director of Lands and Consultation Branch within the Ministry of Government Relations. And she's also an avid golfer, We've never golfed, but I'm pretty sure she'll kick my butt too. Harry LaFon, I don't think golfs. So there's a chance that I might be able to. Harry is the executive director of the Office of the Treaty Commissioner, a former chief of his home community, and a lifetime educator. One of the pioneers in education, has a master's in education. He's also an elected counselor of the Muskeg Lake First Nation and has sat as trustee for the TLE Trust Fund settlement and will provide us with some advice and thoughts for communities as they move through the process of acquiring lands and proceeding with reservation. So I just ask you to welcome our panelists this morning. So before we turn to our panelists and hear from them, you got to hear from me. I'd like to give a brief overview of the history and origins leading up to the Treaty of Land Entitlement Framework Agreement. And this just provides a brief glimpse of the some of the history leading up to the agreement. Our panelists might delve in a little bit deeper in some of the specific areas, but I just want to give a brief glimpse of the origins of Treaty Land Entitlement in Saskatchewan. In the number of treaties, land quantum is identified and is incumbent upon the Crown as represented by the federal government to ensure each band was allotted an appropriate amount of land based on their population. Many First Nations didn't receive the full entitlement of land based on the treaty and therefore created a shortfall of acres that remained for over a century. In 1930, when the federal government transferred lands and resources, and that's a whole other discussion, to the Prairie provinces, it became the responsibility of the provinces to provide unoccupied Crown land to satisfy land entitlement. Despite the initial intentions of assimilation by the federal government through the Indian Act and other policy papers such as the 1969 White Paper, the federal government had no choice but revisit land claims, and as a result of a Supreme Court of Canada ruling, in essence, legitimizing First Nation land claims. So the federal government had to create a policy dealing with land claims back in 1973. Moving through the 70s, it became that land claims had to be dealt with either through negotiation or litigation. With a new policy by the federal government, discussions started in earnest. In 1976, an agreement was reached by governments and First Nations, known as the 76 Formula. However, the implementation of this agreement was unclear and some time elapsed, which resulted in both governments eventually withdrawing their support for the 76 Formula and instead referred back to Data First Survey, which essentially means fulfilling the land quantum based on population at treaty time rather than 1976 population. Of course, most of our communities were larger in 76. Threats of litigation took place, and eventually the four bands in Muskaugan, Ojibwas, Paiute, and Star Blanket launched a claim against government for withdrawing from a negotiated agreement. At the same time, there was public support, other events of discontent, civil disobedience, blockades turned up, and a lot of pressure was on governments to resolve land claims. It was very much the public wanted resolution in land claims. In Saskatchewan, and with the support of the FSI back in the 1990s, the Office of the Treaty Commissioner was created. One of the first tasks was to find and recommend solutions to longstanding treaty land entitlement claims. The efforts of the Office of the Treaty Commissioner created a report which became the foundation for negotiations and eventually led to the 1992 Framework Agreement. In my view, this image is probably one of the most significant events that took place in Saskatchewan. You had First Nation leadership, the Premier of Saskatchewan, the Prime Minister of Canada, come together on September 22, 1992, and signed the Framework Agreement. The event also began the process of informing membership and proposing band by band a long process of ratification and implementation. Implementation of the agreement continues today. More First Nations continue to use the framework as a foundation for resolving their own claims. And a few more bands are currently negotiating their newly validated claims on the basis of the 1992 agreement. Again, last year marked the 20th anniversary of the TLE Framework Agreement, and although there has been significant progress, the work is not over as bands continue to explore their options, acquire lands, create reserved lands, and develop their resources. As time has shown, there comes a time to renew our understanding and educate ourselves about the principles of the 92 Agreement So without further ado, let's welcome our panelists and remind us of the value, the opportunities, the progress, and the implementation of the 1992 agreement. I'd like to call on Dwayne Johns with Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Canada to kick off our presentations. Dwayne, you're fine there.
Can you just stay on that picture for a minute? I want to share a little story with fellow panelists and my guests. I just picture that Ron pointed it out. See Logan Berkeley on the front row. I can't point him out here, but you see him looking
microphone.
He's on the front row here. George LaQuan, the current Treaty Commissioner, tells a story about Ovid's headdress. And I don't know, Ron, if you know this story yet. I thought it was kind of humorous. So if you see George, George LaQuan is in this picture. I'm a fan of the distance of Ovid's hat.
Couldn't you blue? Saskatoon here. Can you put a microphone near the speaker? Thank you.
Anyway, George LaFon tells
the story about Ovid Mercredi. George assured him for the official photograph he wouldn't need his headdress, and of course Ovid is leaning over. I believe Ovid was the chief of the national chief at the time, didn't have his headdress for this picture, so he's leaning over. He's giving it to George, and George is bent over for this historic photograph. So that's who is now the Treaty Commissioner. So I think it was kind of a humorous story. Anyway, Ron, thanks for the introduction. Thank you, Ron, for the invitation to attend this morning. And thanks to those behind the scenes. I'm teasing Ron a little bit this morning in organizing and pulling this event together. I think it's a great opportunity, and welcome to the fellow panel members here this morning. I've got a slide deck that I'd like to walk through, not to repeat what Ron has gone through, and hopefully not to create a whole lot of confusion or questions. I've got a couple of staff here with me that might be able to bail me out. Darcy Prue is in the back. I want to just acknowledge Darcy for his assistance in pulling together this slide deck. And I say that now because if it bombs, then you guys know who to blame. But I've got a bit of a presentation that will speak to some of the achievements. And as Ron mentioned, I think they're pretty significant. And going through them, no, I'm not going to be able to figure this out. But this one. As Ron mentioned, I think the achievements are worth noting. A 20-year celebration back in September kind of caused us to take pause and acknowledge that, yeah, in fact, there's been some good work going on. And I'll go through some of that work from Canada's perspective and tell you a little bit about what I think we've achieved. And I mean, the job isn't finished. I think that's key, is that there a lot of work remains. As Ron mentioned, TLE is a contractual agreement between Canada, the province of Saskatchewan, and 33 First Nations. The original 25 First Nations signed back in 1992. I actually brought a copy of this, a few tabs there for reference, just in case there are difficult questions. 8 subsequent First Nations signed TLE, signed on to the framework agreement after 1992. We're currently under negotiations with 4 new TLEs, looking at the existing framework and seeking to negotiate their own framework agreement. First Nations, as Ron mentioned, are able to purchase land anywhere in the province on a willing buyer, willing seller basis, which was significant. And I'm sure the panel members here will speak to that significance and some of the things that happened prior to 1992. In Saskatchewan, since 1992, 809,308,000 acres have been added to reserve and set apart as what we refer to as entitlement reserves. This slide here, I don't know if you can see the details, but it gives you an idea of the acres that have been added within Saskatchewan region. Going back to about 1994, 95, we ramped up our capacity as a department following the signing of the framework agreement. Canada and the group that I manage and Darcy's in charge of, basically, it had its genesis back in about 1994, 1995 fiscal year.
And the axis on the left there, you'll see the acreage and then the time across the bottom. And some significant achievements, I think, over time, 809,000 acres roughly added. You'll see the peaks in 98, 99, and again in 03, 04. Those were substantial files that Darcy tells me were, you know, primarily was Onion Lake, Peter Ballantyne. There were some huge tracts of land purchased and bought up during those years. But you'll see throughout time how the additions to reserve land quantums, if you will, were kind of up and down throughout the last 20 years. I'll speak to why, people may ask or wonder why the volumes are as low as they are relative to previous years, and I'll get to that later on in my presentation here. The next slide here essentially outlines kind of the task before us. It attempts to compare the equity and honor acres, the total maximum acres available based on the framework represented in the blue bar, and the green just gives you a representation of what's been added to date. So significant work ahead of us. Looking at the total, the 33 current TLE bands, the total land quantum of about 2.2 million acres available to be added under the framework, we've got a long way to go yet. We've got 1.3 million acres to add to reserve. Roughly 30,000 acres per year is what we've been able to achieve. That means it'll take Darcy and I another 40 years to get this work done. I may not be around, Darcy might still be around, but it's a significant amount of work ahead of us and a significant challenge, as Ron says, to kind of maintain the momentum. I think the partnership, one thing that I would say about TLE and the framework, the implementation of the framework agreement, it's a case study on partnerships at all levels of government, of which Ron was a part of when he was with the province, certainly Ron's father, and Treaty Commissioner Office and folks that have kind of gone on before us. So it is, an example of partnership, and one, looking back after 20 years, that, the next 20 years, we look forward to the challenges and opportunity. Shortfall will be referenced within the framework. This is essentially defined as the mandatory minimum amount of land that's required to be purchased instead of apart as reserved as defined under the framework agreement. 23 of the original 25 bands that signed on in 92 have achieved shortfall, and four of those eight, the subsequent eight, four of the eight First Nations with who had signed post 1992 have also achieved shortfall. So six bands have yet to achieve shortfall, and we're looking at between 2,000 and 9,000 acres each remaining before shortfall is achieved. Significance of shortfall, of course, gives the signatory First Nations the opportunity to pursue, I think, a more robust strategy for land selections. It opens up the doors for the selection of urban lands. Urban reserves will be created post shortfall. So shortfall kind of, should be viewed as kind of the mandatory requirements. Once you achieve shortfall, then as a community, there are other opportunities, strategic opportunities that open up to First Nations once they've achieved their shortfall requirements. I won't talk a lot about the history, but prior to 1992, the 25 original First Nation bands had about 595,000 acres of land combined. And what's been achieved, and this is significant, in the last 20 years, these same 25 communities have amassed increases to their reserves totaling about 675,000 acres. So about 113% increase in their land mass. Huge, huge opportunities for these communities. And I think a real takeaway from today and what we've learned over the last 20 years is the opportunities that have been created through the TLE process. Reserve creation process is complicated. I'm up here as a panel member, but I don't pretend to know everything that is in this blue book. There are a lot of folks that know this book intimately, and I will say it's an amazing piece of work. A lot of vision and foresight went into this, and it is held up as a national framework that to this day is still used as the basis for negotiations. I think that's a testament to the work and those that were involved in this negotiation of this framework prior to 1992. It's time-consuming with several different stakeholders involved at a various number of stages within the process. A lot has been made and said about delays to the reserve creation process. You saw in the previous slide that the acreage, the large volumes of tracts of land that were added previously, and now we've kind of, you know, it looks as though momentum has been stalled, and we're down to, you know, 10, 12, maybe 20,000 acres per year added would be a good year. A lot of that is due to complexity. A lot of that, there's a lot of reasons for delays, but addressing third-party interest in today's modern age with the economic potential on the lands and the opportunities that First Nations are exploring through new partnerships has caused a lot of delays and has made these files grow in terms of their complexity. Political pressures and priorities are always changing. I would say at the provincial, national, and First Nation level, those are always hard to kind of marshal politicians to make sure that we're all pulling in the same direction, you know, and as bureaucrats, we take our direction from politicians. Receiving key documentation in a timely manner is a difficult thing. We know staff turnover is an issue, not only for Canada, but we know at the provincial or at the First Nation level, turnover is huge. People that have been on the TLE file at a community level gain and hold a lot of knowledge. They may not have the administrative supports that we as federal bureaucrats are used to and take for granted. So that transition often at the community level has led to, you know, us having to ramp up capacity to get files back on track. Darcy tells me we have about 803 active selections. Some of them have been in the system for 8 to 10 years or longer. And often over 8 to 10 years, that capacity at the community level and keeping that capacity at a high level can be a challenge. Elections, we all know that the elections tend to cause us pause, and I just about said grief. I probably shouldn't say that. joint ventures that deviate from legislation and policy. I will say that First Nations, the capacity at the community level is phenomenal. The ideas that come out of the community level, out of the band office, is phenomenal. The partnerships that they explore and enter into, great work going on. But these joint ventures add a new wrinkle to the process and cause us to deviate from legislation, cause Canada to look at our legislation. The Indian Act isn't the best piece of legislation to implement some of this work, so we've looked at new legislative initiatives as part of this process. It's not on here, but the duty to consult is emerging as one of the biggest issues for us as a federal bureaucracy to come to grips with what our obligations are and the authorities around what do we do when a duty arises. I mean, Darcy and I had that debate and discussion over the last couple of days. So those emerging issues are causing some delays in the process. Talked a little bit about post, once the First Nations achieve shortfall, the opportunity to pursue strategic selections. One thing that's fairly unique to Saskatchewan is the creation of urban reserves. Under the framework agreement. Currently, there are 37 urban reserves in Saskatchewan. We have 39 in progress. Substantial in that I think the next region within the federal system, it would probably be maybe BC or Manitoba, where they have maybe 4 or 5, maybe 6 urban reserves. So urban reserves is kind of a Saskatchewan-made success story, if you will. And you'll see the numbers there dating back to 94, 95, the first urban reserve, I believe, may have been Harry's community. Was it Muskeg, Darcy? I believe it was the first in Canada. Ron, Peter, there we go, Prince Albert. So going back to 94, 95, urban reserves kind of emerged as an opportunity. We see now a number of commercial operations in urban centers, everything from confectionaries, gas stations, to multi-million dollar casinos and hotels. So really a nice spin-off, if you will, from the 92 framework agreement. Roles and responsibilities, I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but basically we have a departmental justice advisor that reviews submissions at the Additions to Reserve Committee stage. ARC is the Additions to Reserve Committee, and at the JACket stage. A JACket simply is a submission that we make to our political masters, whether it's a ministerial order or whether it's an order in council that goes to the Privy Council for reserve creation. And Natural Resources Canada is brought on side. They review selections and provide legal descriptions to reserve to support the reserve creation order, and where necessary, provide certainty on boundaries and help us with surveys. My department conducts the environmental site assessments and identifies any contamination and or requirements for remediation. We don't want to be adding contaminated land, obviously, to the reserve inventory, if we will, so we have to make sure that that contamination, if identified, is addressed prior to reserve creation. The region here, Darcy's team tracks the process from initiation. Initiation happens at the community level right through to the reserve creation and the submission of all of the documents that have to go forward to our minister for him to sign off on the ministerial order. Really, it's a project management role for processing these submissions. And some of the submissions, we have 803 in process. Some of these have been active for 8 to 10 years. So it is a long, detailed process. Strategic opportunities. What does that mean? I think just to close here, the key component to a successful ATR process is a strong emphasis on partnership development, particularly partnerships with the province, the private sector, employers, investors, and developers, relationship building amongst stakeholders, and governance partnerships with municipal and provincial stakeholders as well. That, I think, is the real success story. TLE, as Ron says, TLE is a good news story. Challenges for Saskatchewan, I think, are apparent at the current pace. We will be at this for another 40 years to implement existing obligations. That's not to say that there won't be new and emerging obligations. Last comment I'll make is just the recognition of Saskatchewan's contributions. Saskatchewan, I mean the province, Canada, and First Nations in Saskatchewan. We've recently had a hub, if you will, or center of excellence created in Saskatchewan, acknowledging our expertise in the treaty land entitlement reserve creation process. That hub is a national hub providing support to other regions in Canada. And that hub is located in Saskatchewan. I think the obvious reason is some of the success that we've had over the past 20 years, and that's attributed to people at this table and certainly people at the community level. March 1st, I want to talk a little bit about what's going to happen, you know, what's next for us in terms of reserve creation. Some significant changes, I think, to the Indian Act. A lot has been made of this and said about Bill C-45. I don't want to dwell on it too much, but March 1st, we'll see a streamlined process for land submissions. Land submissions is a process that we basically feed into to create reserves and the designation of those lands for development. So what's been changed under C-45 basically is a streamlined process where our minister will have expanded authorities to sign off on ministerial orders for land designated under the Indian Act. Designation is simply a process where the community sets aside a parcel of land for the commercial development. That's moved from the Privy Council down to our minister. That's significant. The other significant piece is the elimination of the requirement for two votes, a double majority. And I won't get into the complexities of a double majority, but essentially now designations and set-asides can be approved by communities and their membership. It's informed consent. Based on a simple majority, and only one vote will be required. So are we tinkering with the Indian Act? I would say that we're improving it where we get advice from First Nations on what parts of the Act don't make sense. I mean, there's a lot of it that doesn't make sense, but I think March 1, we're going to see some significant changes that will support designation process and the development of TLE First Nation lands. So with that, Ron, I'd just like to thank you for the invite again, and I don't know if you entertain questions or how you want to use.
I should have mentioned at the at the beginning that we'll go through the panel presentations, and then we'll invite questions at the end of the panel presentations. So I should have mentioned that earlier. So our next panelist member is Tricia Delormier-Hill with the province of Saskatchewan. Government relations. She's the, just to remind everybody, she's the executive director of the Lands and Consultation Branch of the newly created Ministry of Government Relations, and has a bit of information to share with the audience today. Tricia.
Yes. Thank you very much, Ron. I'm very happy to be here today. I also have folks here with me from my office. I have Kathy Tice, who also assisted in helping me pull my presentation together and talk about some of the things that I should be covering off. And as well, I'd like to say welcome and thanks for being part of a panel that consists of folks like Dwayne Johns and Harry LaFond here to talk about the different perspectives and experiences on treaty land entitlement. So with that, I will be focusing on the province's participation in treaty land entitlement in Saskatchewan. So through my presentation, I hope to answer the questions that I have up there on the slide in terms of why is the province involved in TLE? What is the significance of the framework agreement? What is the provincial role in TLE implementation process, and what are some of the benefits we've seen from TLE? I often get asked the question, why is the province involved in treaty land entitlement when treaties were entered into between the federal government and the First Nations? And the short answer is that Saskatchewan's participation in TLE stems from the 1930 Natural Resources Transfer Agreement. And basically through the NRTA, Canada transferred to Saskatchewan its interests in all crown land, mines, minerals, and natural resources, with some exceptions like the PA province or the PA National Park. As a condition of the transfer, Saskatchewan agreed to provide unoccupied crown land to Canada so that it could meet its outstanding treaty obligations. Accordingly, Saskatchewan is constitutionally obligated to assist Canada in fulfilling these outstanding TLEs, which is primarily why Saskatchewan is involved. But that's not the only reason. There's also the historic, bringing together of all of the parties to address a long-standing issue. And with the shortfall that was created under treaty, it was important for the province to also see the success of those obligations being met in order to ensure that we can move forward together. The province was involved in, as well, in early attempts to resolve outstanding TLE claims, as well as in the negotiation of the 1992 Saskatchewan TLE Framework Agreement. And I have to say that the very fact that we had Canada, Saskatchewan, and 25 signatory First Nations come to an agreement to resolve outstanding treaty land entitlement claims back in 1992 was a significant achievement. When I first came out west to live and work in Saskatchewan, it was one of the first things that I had heard about from some of my colleagues in the legal field. And I took an immediate interest in that. But I guess we want to know what is the significance of the framework agreement. The framework agreement provides a comprehensive and structured approach to settling TLE claims. And I didn't bring my framework agreement in the blue cover with me because I don't actually have one. They only printed so many of those and they're highly sought after. So I have a smaller, thinner version in my bag with me, but I can probably pull it out if there's questions later. So a more up-to-date, less paper version. But it is comprehensive and contains a number of provisions that help to address a number of issues. It provided money to First Nations to purchase privately owned as well as Crown land anywhere in the province on a willing seller, willing buyer basis to fulfill their entitlements. And the agreements are cost-shared between Canada and Saskatchewan on a 70-30 basis. So the framework agreement has been and continues to serve as a blueprint for settling TLE claims. Since 1992, I think we've mentioned there have been 8 more settled, and it serves for the ones that are currently under negotiation. So what is the provincial role in the TLE process? Basically, through the Ministry of Government Relations, we're responsible for coordinating the implementation of TLE agreements. We serve as a single window into government for the TLE process. Our lands unit the ministry works with 13 ministries, agencies, and Crown corporations to coordinate this provincial review process. And we have a provincial TLE review committee comprised of representatives from each of the key ministries and Crown corporations that meets to ensure that the process is running smoothly. The implementation of TLE agreements involves a provincial review of lands prior to reserve creation by the federal government. The first step in the review process is having the First Nation notify the province and/or Canada in writing of its intention to acquire a piece of property under its agreement. The province then reviews the selection to identify any provincial or third-party interests in the land and has 90 days to respond by letter to the First Nation in Canada. The First Nation is responsible for resolving all third-party interests and provincial interests prior to lands transferring to reserve status. So just to give you a picture of some of the things that come up and are identified or may be contained in a provincial response on after reviewing lands that are selected by a First Nation include things like utilities. So we mention our utilities such as Sask Energy, SaskTel, and SaskPower, where if there's utilities on the land, replacement agreements may be required for permits or easements. We also identify any roads that may be excluded or need to be widened or closed, as well as water bodies, whether they're to be included or excluded from the land under selection. Through our Ministry of Education, we also identify the affected school divisions and rural municipalities that would receive compensation for lost taxes resulting from lands transferring to reserve status. And we also have our Crown Land Administering Ministries, which are the Ministry of Environment and Agriculture, identify third-party interests such as leaseholders and outfitters. So once that's done, the responsibility rests with the First Nation to resolve those interests prior to reserve creation, and as Dwayne mentioned, the federal government is then responsible for actually establishing the land as reserve. So what are some of the benefits that we've seen under TLE? Overall, we continue to make progress on TLE. Over $595 million has been provided to 33 First Nations to transfer up to 2.3 million acres to reserve status. And I think Dwayne already mentioned, since 92, we have over 809,000 acres that have been created in Saskatchewan. And 27 of the 33 First Nations that have acquired their shortfall either continue to acquire additional lands, referred to as equity acres, or they can then, after they meet their minimum requirement, choose to use that money for economic or social development purposes in the community. The increasing of the reserve base in Saskatchewan has had positive economic benefits for First Nations. We see some of the lands acquired are in the vicinity of First Nations original reserve lands, but some are obviously chosen for economic benefit in urban or rural centers. And many successful businesses have been established and jobs created for First Nations members, as well as spin-offs for surrounding communities. We see things such as gas bars, convenience stores, leasing of office space, leasing of lands for agricultural purposes, development of minerals, which sometimes involves joint venture opportunities with the private sector. All of which to say is that this is all contributing to the benefit that we see from resolving this historic shortfall. The success of the process of resolving TLE is largely due to the collaborative efforts, I would say, as well, and echo the comments earlier, between First Nations Canada and Saskatchewan, and also with the assistance of the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations on issues that are common to the TLE First Nations. But obviously, there is more work left to be done. We're not completed. There is no expiry date on the agreements. So as long as the First Nations haven't acquired all the land that they're entitled to under those agreements, the work will be here for quite some time. So what does the future hold? Basically, this historic agreement continues to apply today, as you can see, and as we're all always very busy. And it represents, and since its inception, a one-of-a-kind, unique, innovative, and collaborative approach to settling a complex area of land claims in the numbered treaty context. As I said before, it contains a comprehensive implementation process, and anyone who deals in any type of land claims or settlement agreements knows that the implementation portion of an agreement is critical. It's always great to see an agreement reached, but it's what the parties do with it afterwards to bring it to life. And the framework agreement continues to serve as the blueprint for the settlement of new TLE claims. And I'll end there.
Thank you, Tricia. Thanks for that presentation. And before we move on to our next presentation, I just want to welcome and introduce a friend of mine, Vice Chief Simon Bird with the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations. He's the second Vice Chief, fourth Vice Chief. Responsible for education and other areas, of course, and is in town for a gathering at the First Nation University that he's hosting. So he's taken some time from that busy event to come and join us and listen in on the presentation. So I just wanted to say welcome to one of our leaders from the First Nation community. Thanks, Vice Chief, for coming and listening in. Our next presenter is also a leader in First Nation country out there, former chief of the Muskeg Lake, as I mentioned earlier, and currently a counselor with the community and past trustee of his community on the TLE Trust, has some good information. And as mentioned earlier, Muskeg Lake was a bit of a pioneer in treaty settlement, going back to the early 90s. Some of the work that and the risks that the community had taken. Harry was part of that. We really appreciate his taking the time to join us from the Office of the Treaty Commissioner, more as the role of a trustee. Harry LaFont, please help us out today.
Well, good morning. The story I'm going to share with you is less about numbers and statistics and more about the people experience that is related to or that comes out of the agreement. Muskeg Lake went through two different processes. Prior to the 1992 agreement, Muskeg negotiated an urban reserve in Saskatoon, and that was signed in 1988. And that particular experience helped in the formation of the 1992 agreement. Many of the questions that that had to be dealt with in terms of policy and federal government approach to reserve creation, drawn from our experience in 1988. Well, when I think back on what happened in 1992, in September 22, 1992, my first thought is that the signing of that agreement was the easy part, even though it seemed quite painful, you know, from 1988 to 1992 when we met in different forums, and you try to get 25 chiefs to agree to move forward together. It seemed very painful, but in retrospect, that was far easier than what followed 1992. And I'll try to explain why I think about it from that perspective. What we have to keep in mind here is the context the environment that the First Nations were living in prior to 1992. We were just basically coming out of an era of isolation and alienation, and so movement from the reserve was just in its first generation into the urban communities, and the thinking in the community was very much insular. So you take that environment and you thrust an agreement like the TLE agreement of 1992, you are challenging a community to make to become transformed in a very short space of time. Okay, and I lived and survived that period. Some of the transformation that occurred, there are some elements that were absolutely necessary. And so, from Muskeg's perspective, here some of the points that that I want to speak to have to do with creating a team. Once that agreement was signed by Muskeg Lake, and we realized what it involved, or had an inkling what it involved, having an effective team to move and bring life to this agreement for our community involved having individuals. One was somebody who knew about land and somebody who understood purchasing and the acquisition of land outside of the Muskeg Lake proper, and somebody who had some business savvy, somebody who, an individual who was able to operate in the business community of Saskatchewan with some success and some understanding. So that kind of a person was necessary. On the transformation side, the people needed to understand what wealth creation meant. It was a foreign concept in the sense that it wasn't something that we were encouraged to think about. So wealth creation, so we needed somebody who would be able to explain that and get people talking about it and moving, changing in that direction. We needed somebody who understood the gap between the way the community was prior to the agreement and the way the community needed to be post the agreement. And this meant understanding engagement, how to engage people in a process, how to bring them along so that when it was time for decisions to be made, they would be making them with the appropriate knowledge and the appropriate understanding of the agreement and the implications that it had for the future. Very important. We needed somebody on that team who understood bureaucracies more than just the Indian agent. We needed somebody who was very comfortable networking and finding the right advocates inside the Saskatchewan government bureaucracy, the federal government bureaucracy, the municipalities, and First Nations bureaucracies. So that's a tall order, but it's absolutely necessary if you want to get this process working efficiently and effectively, and not taking 20 years to have your first parcel turned to reserve status. And probably one of the greatest challenges was understanding the legal language. I mean, Muskeg people are Cree people, and the older generation are Cree speakers. And then you throw lawyer language at them. It's challenging. So the agreement required some action in terms of a specific agreement and a trust agreement. These are sort of components of the umbrella agreement. This was our buy-in into the agreement, and in order for us to buy into the agreement, we had to have a really high percentage of our members agree and vote and agree to the terms. And so that becomes a challenge. And as I indicated earlier, the language wasn't Cree, it was legalese. And the question we immediately asked was, does anyone speak the language? And so it was really challenging to be able to take that legal language and convert it into everyday Muskeg language so that people would understand what we were talking about, what the lawyer was talking about, what the TLE coordinator was talking about, and what the expectations were. The other challenge that faced us, remember the environment. It was very insular, and so the community looked at itself inwards rather than outwards. So what happened inside that 4x7 piece of land was the most important, and what happened outside of that was secondary to that. All of a sudden, this agreement asked us to re-establish contact with all our members. So that expression about Canada being from sea to sea to sea really became a real challenge for us, because our membership was all over Canada. And in significant numbers that we couldn't ignore it. And so this was a whole new world for the Muskeg Lake Council and the Muskeg Lake people to think about how to engage a membership that they're not used to engaging. So again, it's a transformation process. It's led us into a type of government that is very very sensitive to communicating with band membership. In fact, in today's world, Muskeg has adopted their own law that they must report to membership twice a year, once in the spring and once in the fall. So and that came out of that experience, that need to reconnect. The third challenge that we faced was selling a dream. Like, it's one thing you can take a car into a community and you can put a for sale sign on it and people can touch it and they can get into it and they can pretend they're driving it. But treaty land entitlement is not like that. You can't put your hand on it because it doesn't become real until after people agree to the process. And so there we were crossing the country selling a dream to people who in many respects had become disconnected from the Muskeg Lake of their history. So it was a challenge. And not only that, but in the voting process, it was not 50% plus one. It was a lot higher than that. You had to have a certain percentage of your membership actually showing up to vote, and of that percentage, there was another high percentage of them had to say yes. So it was a very challenging and a very high bar that was set to make this agreement real. So it really became an interesting process, and we in Muskeg we kind of solved that problem by appealing to impact of per diems and free meals. So we crossed the country and we gave per diems for people who showed up for meetings and showed up to vote, and we also fed them really well. Meals. There is not an Indian who will say no thank you to a good meal. And they'll come back for second helpings. The other factor that we had to work on, and we had to work on it fairly quickly, was building an identity for ourselves. Like Muskeg had, in order for us to sell a dream, we had to back it up by building a sense of loyalty and a sense that, of community with the people that we were trying to re-engage into our community. And so we spent a lot of energy just trying to pull together the story of Muskeg Lake, the story of the family, so that people could relate and have a way to to engage themselves into what it was that we were bringing to their plate. The one important tough message that we had to deliver, as we looked west and we realized that the way our neighbors, our relatives in Hobima had handled trust money was in many respects not good for their community, that they were suffering a lot of social problems as a consequence of the way they had set up the payouts to their band members. And so we had to make the tough decision fairly early on to say there is no free money. Free money is not real. And so it was not an easy message to deliver, because the expectation was, well, we're going to get a pile of money here. What's in it for me? And so we had to deal with the issue, and we dealt with it from the perspective of an investment process. We need land to build wealth. And we need to, and that wealth will benefit all of the membership. And there will be opportunities that will come with the development of that land. Opportunities for employment, opportunities for becoming engaged in your own, taking care of yourself. Mat Siswin, to take care of yourself, pass that work ethic on to your children. So that message was not an easy message to deliver, but we had to deliver it, and I'm glad we did. So that's sort of the difficult process of the specific and the trust agreements. it was getting that approval from the membership. It was a long process, but it was also a very engaging and growing process for the community. We learned about communication. We learned about looking outwards from the 4x7, and we learned that how important it was for people to understand the potential of this agreement in looking forward to their children and grandchildren. Inside the process, it wasn't just a question of purchasing land. Our advisors told us very early on, you need to have a plan. Don't just go out there and buy land. They said, you can be land rich. You can have lots of land, but if it's not, if its potential is fairly low, then that's all you have. And so they advised us to pull together a land purchasing plan, focusing on strategy, on Muskeg Lake's long-term vision for itself. And of course, wealth creation was part of that vision, an important part of that vision. And so in that land plan, then how it developed over that over the first couple of years was focus on urban land purchasing, lands that that are have the potential for some type of development, whether it's park type of developments, lakes, etc. And then lands that would support current activity in Muskeg Lake. We have a fair number of people, fair families who still hunt. So that's how the plan worked out. And then we disciplined ourselves to begin to look for land from that plan. We also had to make sure that people understood the difference between shortfall and land purchased after shortfall. That really shortfall was kind of a bottleneck in this process, because you had to achieve shortfall, have it converted to reserve before it would free up the activity with the money that we had received for the land. And that was important. We needed to get past the shortfall fairly quickly. And fortunately, Muskeg only had about 2,800 acres, I think, that they had to purchase to not at all like some of the other bands that had lots and lots of land to acquire before they could move into the other part of the agreement. The challenge we had experienced under the 1988 agreement was understanding that the reserve land as is, you can do very little with it economically, commercially. And so we went through the designation process for that. We learned from that experience and brought it into the 1992 agreement. The designation process is absolutely necessary if you're purchasing land that you're going to do some kind of commercial type of development. And what we did eventually was we tied the designation process with the ATR process, so that when we had a vote, the people were voting for both, and they knew it. They were voting for both. So now anytime we have a piece of land converted to reserve status, it automatically becomes designated land. And so we save costs that way, and the designation process is well understood in the community, so it doesn't pose any problems. When we look at the future of treaty land entitlement, the most immediate future we looked at in Muskeg Lake in the late 1990s was We looked at the trust agreement, and as a trustee for my community, we realized that really the trust agreement had some weaknesses inside of it. It allowed for outflow too easily. The money could be used for a lot of different things, and the terminology was fairly broad, and so you could, if you were real smart, you could get money out of there for a lot of different things and not necessarily for the good of your community. And so we thought as leaders of Muskeg Lake that we had to do something about that. And so in the late 1990s, we again went to our membership and we asked them to vote on creating almost like another trust around the trust agreement. And that second trust virtually locks in the money. The reason being, we were poor in 1980s. We didn't have a nickel to, two nickels to rub together. And it's, and when the people realized that we had, you know, some money in the bank, it changes the perception of who they are. They have some wealth, and that wealth gives them a sense of hope. And so we wanted to maintain that thinking and that identity. And so we have this trust. We use the interest money, not all of it, because we put some back into the principal to make sure that the principal stays in tune with the inflation and all the other things that affect money. And then we take that interest money, and we've identified very specifically what that interest money is going to be used. Some of it's used for housing, some of it's support for elders, education, purchase of land, and economic development. And then I think we have one miscellaneous just in case, you know, in case you need that a little extra. But that's the way we viewed the future for Muskeg Lake. That's the way we try to ensure that foundation continues to exist there and supports the economic growth and development that's a part of our long-term plan. In terms of the future and recent experiences with treaty land entitlement, our concern, not only in Muskeg, but also where I work, the Office of the Treaty Commissioner, is that people are beginning to forget the partnership. And so I think it's time, after 20 years, for bureaucracies and partners to reinvigorate that agreement. And I think the main concern is that as people retire, they take with them the knowledge that they have and the understanding that they have of the spirit and intent of this agreement inside of that partnership. And the new people don't have the benefit of that history, or they only have bits and pieces of that history. So I think if we're looking forward to this partnership, the TLE partnership, in order for it to stay healthy and to stay as a strong potential for the growth of this province, Saskatchewan, we need to invigorate by taking a serious look at that agreement and capturing the spirit and intent, because those people that built this agreement are still around. We can draw on their experience and knowledge to get that. But that has to happen with the political leadership, but also, most importantly, the bureaucrats who work for those governments. So in order for us to maintain that, call it playing a winning hand, we have to take this kind of a step seriously, and we need to do it fairly quickly. Because if we don't, and the indicators are out there, we're going to all end up in court, and it's going to cost us a whole pile of money, and it's going to systematically destroyed a partnership. And we don't want that. We live in a beautiful province. It was built with the intent of a strong partnership. But partnerships need to be maintained, and we haven't been very good at doing that. So we need to get to work.